We discussed one issue of real property and continued on the superintendent's mid-year evaluation. Pursuant to our discussion in closed session, the board has action to take in open session tonight. We are looking for approval of the superintendent's recommendation to dismiss employee number 52-808, a special education paraeducator 1, by roll call vote. May I have a motion?
I move approval of the superintendent's recommendation.
I'll second.
So we have a motion by Mr. Questenberry, a second by Mr. Buckman. Mrs. Holmes?
Mr. Questenberry?
Aye.
Mr. Buckman?
Aye.
Dr. Eisenbath Rogers?
Aye.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Mrs. Sheffer?
Yes.
Mr. Millar?
Yes.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
Thank you. Do we have consensus on the order of business?
Yes.
Apparently we do. I am looking for, we have several sets of minutes to approve. Minutes of 112, 122, and 125.
I'll move approval of the minutes of January 12th.
I'll second.
Motion by Mr. Millar, second by Mr. Questenberry. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes unanimously. The minutes of 122.
I'll move approval of the minutes of January 22nd, 2016.
And I'll second that. So we have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer, a second. We give our board members a chance or people in the audience? Okay, I'm reminded that anyone who wishes to modify or revise the minutes should speak up at the time of the motion. So we have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer, second by myself, on the minutes of January 22nd. Those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? And we have one abstention by Mr. Millar and a second abstention by Mr. Unger. Okay, so you're abstaining as well?
I should
not have made a motion. Okay. Let's go back and have a new motion. I'll move approval of the minutes of January 22nd.
And I'll second.
So a motion by myself, second by Dr. Eisengrath Rogers. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstentions? So we have four ayes, three abstentions, and none opposed. Okay. And then moving on to the minutes of January 25th. Motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Millar. Does anyone have any questions or issues about these minutes? Seeing none, those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Got one.
Mr.
Abstain,
okay. So we have anyone opposed? Okay. So we have six ayes, none in opposition, and one abstention. Okay. Okay. Student representatives to the board. We have Bella Stanvall with us from San Luis Obispo High School.
Hello.
Hello.
So there's a lot going on at San Luis Obispo High School for the past couple of weeks. We finished up with our winter formal, which was last Saturday. We brought in about 300 kids, and it was called Night in Black and White. So that was a successful event for our students. Also, our Skills USA team will compete in Paso Robles this weekend. Our Slow Robotics team actually hosted their own robotics competition at Cal Poly this past Saturday, which was a very big success, which we are happy about. Our mock trial team has been competing. They're continuing to compete throughout the week, which has been another really great organization that all of our students have been benefiting from. In sports, all of our winter sports have been very successful. We've had a couple of very big basketball games. We beat Arroyo Grande last Friday, and we've had a couple of really big games. Our girls' varsity soccer team is still undefeated, which is very fun for us. So we're going to go out and support them at home this Friday, as well as our boys' teams and JV teams. Also, we have a student congress, which has representative from every second period class. And those meetings run twice a month, and our students said that they wanted to have water refill stations since the quality of our water fountains at our school is pretty abysmal, actually, at this point. So Mr. O'Connor has been working with us, and this three-day weekend we will have two brand-new filtered water refill stations and drinking fountains in at our campus, which is really great because also it shows the importance of our student congress because that came directly from that meeting, and we were able to see that it happened. So that was very cool for us. Also, we're running a counselor appreciation week. We have three counselors on our campus for our 1,400 students, so we're running a very special week for them, including a video talking about what they can do, the challenges and the best parts of their jobs, just to make sure that students are aware of how much they do for us and to give them a little special recognition, especially towards the end of college application time since it's been a long haul for them at this point. Also, we had put up our crisis text line posters, which I talked about in the last meeting. At the bottom of those posters were about 25 slips that you could cut off, just pull off, and you would have the number. And we put up 55 posters around campus, and there was about, I think, 30 slips at the bottom of each one. And I'd say about 85% of the posters on campus have every single slip completely pulled. So on one hand, I think it's a testament to show how many of our students are struggling with things on campus outside of what they deal with every day at school. But also, it's really great that that resource is now out there and that many students now have the opportunity to use that to their advantage. So it's a two-sided coin, but it's a very good thing, I think, that they have that resource. Also, we have a film festival, our very first film festival going on, which is going to be on the 12th after, actually in our gym, after a varsity basketball game. And we are looking for a judge, preferably from the school board, actually. The films are about 7 minutes long. We're expecting we're going to get about five from students. And how it works is you would get a file with all the films on it and a scorecard, and you would watch them and then sort of rank them and be part of our film festival judges. There's a $200 prize for first place, $100 for second, third for $50, and then a best actor and best actress prize. And they have these really beautiful gold trophies that look a little bit like Oscars. So it's a very fun thing that we're doing at our school. So it's a good way for us to incorporate the arts. And I actually sent Ms. Holmes our commercial for that, which is a couple seconds long. But just to entice you, if you would like to be a judge, also to show what our video production does.
Bella?
Yes.
I would love to be a judge.
Yes, we would love that. Perfect. So the way we do most of our advertising is actually with commercials like that. We basically advertise almost all of our events and programs with two video tech commissioners, which we have, both of which who are very passionate about videos. They're actually both applying to USC Film School and a bunch of big film schools because that's what they're really into. So, I mean, that's barely even a testament to what they're doing as far as how they're helping us make our school look really, really good over our daily bulletin as far as how we publicize our events. But Ms. Eisenjath, thank you. Then I will talk to you about that. That'd be great.
Thank you, Bella. Certainly, Mr. Millar.
Bella, do you think the number of slips of paper that are gone, it's also a reflection of the, shall we say, private ability of students to access this service without having to, say, go to the counseling office and these other things?
I would think so. I think that the ability to text a counselor as opposed to perhaps making a call or even meeting with someone does make it a little more convenient and also very private as far as how you can get that sort of assistance. So I think that it's a very unique resource. I had never heard of something like that until the past couple of weeks when we sort of discovered it on a TED Talk, actually. So I think that that probably has a lot to do with why it's been so popular as far as what we can tell from our sort of data from seeing how many slips have been pulled.
That's good. I think SLOHI has done a number of outreach things that have been very impressive.
Oh, good.
Keep up
I
the good
so.
Work.
Do you know if there will be any follow-up done in terms of just numbers, of course not any information or anything else, but in terms of how many texts the counselors actually receive?
So this actually, the counselors that are used for this crisis text line aren't our school counselors. It is a, it's a nationwide program run by a nonprofit, actually. So these are trained crisis counselors, but they do pride themselves actually on their data. If you go on their website, you can see they have an entire page where you can see stats as far as what times of the day kids are asking about certain issues, the popularity of different issues, also something where it says the keywords associated with different issues like depression or anxiety, and so they have a ton of statistics. I actually think I should inquire as far as if we can get information particularly relating to our school, because I know they have that, but it would be very interesting to see. So that's actually a really great idea. I'll follow up on that.
Okay, great.
So
thank you.
Yeah,
thanks very much.
Mr. Quasimiri.
Well, I just want to tell Bella just how much I appreciate her reports, and they're very thorough, they're very interesting to listen to, and you're very articulate, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, then, thank you very much for coming and for your report. As always, you're welcome to stay or welcome to go if you have other commitments. Okay. Moving on, at the time the agenda was published, the board had received no correspondence. If anyone has individual correspondence they'd like to report out. Okay, seeing none, it's time for public comment.
We do have two.
So we have received two requests to address the board. During public comment, speakers have 3 minutes, and Dr. Eisengrath Rogers will call for the first speaker.
The first speaker is Genevieve Check.
Good evening, ladies, gentlemen of the board, student representatives, and members of the audience. I am a resident of San Luis Obispo and formerly was a substitute teacher for 15 years, K through 12, with San Luis District. I'm here tonight to represent mothers, fathers, grandparents, and I'm a great-grandparent, on a very serious issue. I would like to present and promote a petition. It is about parental notification. It's entitled Parental Notification and Child and Teen Safety. And we are requesting an initiative on the 2016 ballot. As the current California law is written, the parents of a 15-year-old girl, for example, would not be notified should their daughter procure a medical or surgical abortion. Many of these teenage abortions are furthermore chemical. Many girls under 18, 15, as young as 13 and 12, visit the abortion center for the pill, the RU486. They return 2 days later for a second part of the drugs. They go home and expel the baby in the toilet, sometimes profusely bleeding, sometimes experiencing alarming side effects. Then they return to the center to make sure the abortion is complete. What kind of things cannot be done without the parents' consent with a teenage minor? They cannot get a flu shot, nor a cavity filled, nor receive an aspirin from a school nurse without their parents' consent. Yet, that same girl can get a surgical or medical abortion without one of her parents knowing. About a year ago, a high school girl, not from San Luis High School, but from our area, was dropped off at the local San Luis Planned Parenthood Center for an abortion. She was dropped off by a school, I think the school nurse. At 5 o'clock, no one had come to collect her. The center told her she had to leave. She left. She was having Valium, was disoriented and bleeding, and she called her mother a few blocks away. You can imagine her mother was appalled, having thought her daughter was at school that day. 39 states in America have already enacted parental notification legislation. California could and should be number 40. These laws have proven effective in deterring sexual exploitation of minor girls, reductions in pregnancy, and sexually transmitted diseases among minors. Minnesota changed its law in 1989. Its teenage abortion rate dropped by 70.7%. Qualifying and passing a parental notification amendment is of crucial importance in California. Approximately 20,000 abortions per year are performed on minor girls in California. That is one-fifth of all the minor abortions in the United States. If you are a parent or an educator or a grandparent, someone who is concerned about our vulnerable girls, think about what your child would go through secretly as a victim or a friend of someone involved in an abortion. You might also be alarmed to realize you are the grandparent of the aborted child. If you're a teacher who becomes involved in a minor's abortion, the moral responsibility is very grave indeed. I am leaving a copy of the petition. You can read the details on the back and a flyer and details on how to fill it in with Mrs. Holmes, who's taking it into the office. And I know, end of story, you've got the details in the office. Thank you.
Thank you.
And the next person. We have a second speaker. Mr. Robert Myers.
Hello, everyone. Hope everyone's having a great evening tonight. My name is Robert Myers, and I am a fourth-year Cal Poly student, a future teacher, hopefully. And so my sort of question or comment or sort of hoping to gain a better understanding of why student representatives aren't permanent members of your board. 4 years ago when I was in high school, I was vice president of ASB, and as such, one of my duties was to be a standing member of our school board. And I feel like the sort of expectation of you being there week after week and being involved in decisions that, in all effect, you know, affect the greater school population is something that will empower students to be more involved and empower students to feel like they actually have a voice. You know, as Mr. Questenberry noted, Bella was very eloquent in her speech, in her report, and I feel like, you know, people like that, sort of as an example for others, you know, sort of year after year, a good turnover is something that can definitely be expected if it is expected of students to be contributing members to a school board. And so I feel maybe, you know, maybe a little far-reaching, only being, you know, a college student in this town, but, you know, sort of seeing and knowing the impact of being wanted, sort of maybe a suggestion is to look into the possibility of, you know, having your student representatives be permanent members of your board to increase their awareness of topics, but also to increase their input on different things. Thank you.
Thank you. The business and budget update. Mr. Pinkerton.
We are moving forward to second interim right now, and so that should be coming to the board very soon in terms of our update and where we're at with the budget. Amy, Kim, and myself attended an LCAP kind of in-service that was put on by West Ed last week on Thursday, and it was a really, you know, it was a long day in terms of talking about one subject, and so you realize what students have to go through all day long, every day, right, as part of that. But we did walk away with some good things, and really the stakeholder engagement, I would say, was kind of a key topic for us and things we can do. And I've already begun talking with Ms. Robinette about our presentation and things we can do to improve it in the future based on that. But there was a lot of hope in terms of the LCAP itself and accountability and, you know, with No Child Left Behind going away and the new potential federal standards and those types of things. And so the presenter gave a really dynamic presentation in terms of their tie-in with the State Board of Education, because they are kind of the ones that are helping them create the rubric, creating the actual plan, trying to simplify it, make it a lot more user-friendly. So I think we walked away with a lot of good ideas and suggestions, and it's exciting to hear some of the things that we used to have to do under No Child Left Behind, notifying parents about school sites and poor achievement and things, and kind of reframing that in a more positive way as we move forward was a real positive thing. So I'm sure we'll be sharing more information about that with the board.
Thank you. Mr. Quesenberry.
After attending this, how did you feel about where we are as far as the LCAP process goes?
So I would say we're definitely, in terms of our LCAP itself and what's contained in our LCAP, I think we're way, way far ahead in terms of most groups. You know, one of the biggest things they said was to really narrow down your focus. So I think the fact that we have six focus areas was something that, you know, kind of kudos to us. And some groups have 30, 40 types of things that they're trying to work on in focus areas. So that was a big one. This, again, a lot of stakeholder engagement. What she talked a lot about was reframing the conversation with how you have the engagement. I think for us, as we go around, we elicit it. I think we get a lot of good information from our anonymous survey that we put out to staff, those types of things. But there's definitely ways that I think, again, where we can make it more of a process where they get more involved. So kind of changing it up a little bit, having things out, making people come and be part of the conversation versus just simply asking them questions, waiting for their input, kind of, you know, getting them involved in the process. So those are some of the key things that we walked away with. But overall, great shape.
Any other comments? Mr. Robinette, then the Educational Services update.
Are we on? Okay, thank you. If my calculations are right, we finished the 96th day of instruction today, which means it's hard to believe, but we are well over the halfway mark. Which in the departments I work with, it means that we start focusing on 16-17 in earnest right now. It's almost like the school year's done and we're moving on. So, you know, LEA planning and consolidated app and all the LCAP stuff, enrollment projections, which is what I was working on today, staffing, hiring. We had a STRS representative out to the school district today to talk about retirements and kindergarten roundup. All those things become part of our daily work this time of year. We have had some really great staff developments in the last couple weeks at both the elementary and secondary level with math and language arts. I had the opportunity to sit in a lively discussion with our wonderful teacher on special assignment, Mrs. Del Martini, and our middle school English teachers as they were grappling with aligning standards to units of study and common assessments and the energy and the professionalism of just kind of arguing and coming down with some common ideas is really refreshing. I mean, there's healthy disagreements and that turn into healthy agreements, and I think that's a good place for our professionals to be. A lot of high school math work the last week, working with the new CPM materials. We're continuing to kind of unpack the NGSS science standards as we kind of progress with that. The board should have got an invitation, I believe, yesterday from Mr. Allstott, one of the assistant principals at Morro Bay High School, as you know, this group of students here at Los Osos Middle School are articulating right up to high school in the ninth grade, and so there's a lot of work being done at Morro Bay to kind of prepare for this group who have been in a three-year STEAM education program, and what are they stepping into at the high school level. And so I would certainly invite the board either tomorrow or Thursday if you want to stop by and see some of what's happening in terms of their work with project-based learning, working with a school in San Diego, High Tech High, and some of the things they have done to kind of foster STEAM education at the high school level. Want to also remind the board that next Friday, a week from this Friday, February 12th, we have a study session on assessment, kind of asking the question, why do we give assessments? Are we giving too many? What are the purposes? What's happening with testing and assessment in our district? So if the board has specific things they would like addressed in that study session, please get in touch with me or email me or give me a call so we can make sure we address that in the study session next Friday. And lastly, I just want to mention that that afternoon on the 12th, we will, I think for the fourth year, be participating with the Slow Leadership program. It's an offshoot of the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce, and they traditionally ask San Luis Coastal to work with them as far as presenting kind of the state of public education in our community. And so really pleased our own Kim McGrath has kind of taken charge of that this year, and so I know we'll have other people participating, and we'll also be bringing up Dan Neff from New Tech High in Lucia Mar to be part of that presentation. But we're looking forward to that next Friday afternoon after our study session. And I think that's what I have to report.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay. Seeing none, we'll move on to the Measure D update.
Yes, yeah, so we actually have an item for the board later on the agenda, bridging document contract with an architecture firm. And so Mr. Holcomb and myself really have spent last week putting that contract together. It's something different than what we did with our architect contracts, in that this is a specific project that will kind of take us from the planning phase up into either schematic or design documents, depending on the project, at both San Luis Obispo High School as well as Morro Bay High School, so that we can. And it's a really tight timeline for us to try to get this accomplished by June, to bring that to the board, to have an RFP so that we can go out for a design build, try to find a design build entity to do those projects, whether it be one for both or one for each. That'll be something that's going. But as part of that process, as we discussed at the last study session, we really need to kind of move forward and get those design documents put together. The department is doing a great job, facilities maintenance operations, so kudos to Anthony and his team, getting those district specs put together, gathering all of the information that's going to be critical to have for those firms when they come in to do the designs. On top of that, I will say that Measure D is, we were going at 5 miles an hour, and now we're at about 30. So I can see it picking up, and projects and where we're at, and so there's excitement with that, because we just want to get some shovels in the ground and get moving, and so it's good to see in terms of all of our systems are getting put in place. We have a few kind of things that we're going to be doing to look at those systems to make sure that we're on the right path. But overall, what I'm seeing, the documents, the dialogue between Mr. Holcomb, the department, myself, I think has been really beneficial, and I think we're on the right path.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, then we'll move on. We have a public hearing. The district's 2016-2017 bargaining interests with SEIW.
So we have a series of ratifications here in front of you. The first one is SEIU, and we are beginning to meet with SEIU in another month or two. And so before you, you will find the board's interests on before we start negotiating with SEIU for the next successor agreement. So if you have questions. This is a public hearing.
Okay, so then I will open the public hearing. Is there any member of the public that has input to give on the board's interest with SEIU? Seeing no one, I'll close the public hearing. Any board questions? Okay, then moving on, we have item 9.01, a resolution. Number 09-15-16, layoff of an educational interpreter position.
So we have this is a new position that we established this year because we had the need for an educational transcriber position because of a student that was at San Luis Obispo High School, and he is no longer attending San Luis Obispo High School and has moved back to a district in North County, and so we no longer have the need for this position. This employee is a fantastic employee. She will have a 39-month reemployment right should we have another position that's required of this nature. And we are sad that we're having to lay the position off, but it is simply a lack of work.
Okay. So
our recommendation is that you adopt the resolution.
So I'm looking for someone to move the resolution.
You want to go to the public first?
Oh, is there anyone from the public who would like to comment? Seeing no one. Mr. Quessenberry.
I'll move resolution number 09-15-16.
I'll second.
So we have a motion by Mr. Quessenberry, second by Mr. Millar.
Mr. Quessenberry?
Aye.
Mr. Millar?
Aye.
Mr. Unger?
Yes.
Mrs. Scheffer?
Yes.
Mrs. Roger?
Yes.
Dr. Eisenbath Rogers?
Yes.
Mr. Buckman?
Yes.
Passes 7-0.
Thank you.
Thank you. Item 10.01, secondary ELA ELD program. Mrs. McGrath.
Good evening. I'm here with Sandra Del Martini and Don Addis, who are going to present tonight on an update for secondary English language arts from Ms. Del Martini and English language development from Ms. Addis. So I'm excited to tell you about a lot of the developments that are happening with our secondary schools in those two areas. I'll come back up at the end to summarize and, of course, answer any questions you have.
Good evening. I'm Sandra Del Martini. I'm the secondary ELA TOSA, and I'm very appreciative of the opportunity to speak with you this evening about what's going on at our secondary sites. So first, I'd like to speak with you about the shifts that are occurring in the Common Core standards. Due to the implementation of the Common Core standards in our schools, four major shifts have taken place. Students have traditionally read more fiction than nonfiction in the classroom, and the Common Core ELA literacy standards are addressing this imbalance by placing more emphasis on reading nonfiction. We know that instructional and informational texts play an important role in building students' content knowledge. And under the new standards, students are expected to not only develop research skills, but also be able to analyze and synthesize what they read. Previously, students may have only been required to reference one source. Now in their essays, we're asking them to reference multiple sources from various areas. The next area of shift is in academic language. There's a direct link between vocabulary and comprehension, and it's essential that we help students develop a deep understanding of terms that they cannot acquire through independent reading. Through the study of academic vocabulary that's integrated into our lessons and not taught in isolation, students are exposed to words that are traditionally used in academic dialogue and text. These words help them understand oral directions, participate in classroom discussions, and comprehend text across different content areas. There are three tiers of academic vocabulary. The first tier are known as first-tier words, obviously, and they are commonly known words such as big, house, and family. The second tier are known as Tier 2 words, and they are cross-curricular vocabulary. And these are words that are found in written text and are often shared between the teacher and the student. For example, the terms notation and expression would be words that you would hear in both math and English, but in completely different contexts. And the third tier are known as Tier 3 words that are domain-specific, which means that they're critical to understanding the concepts of that specific content that's being taught. And examples of those words would be isotope, sovereign, and onomatopoeia. Our third shift is evidence from text. The Common Core emphasizes using evidence from text to present careful analyses, well-defended claims, and clear information. Previously, we asked students questions that they could answer from their prior experience or from their prior knowledge. Now we ask students to base their responses on evidence that they have acquired from the text that they have read. And our fourth shift is speaking and listening. By speaking and listening to others, language becomes a tool to teach students how to effectively engage in a wide range of collaborative discussions. By incorporating active listening and speaking activities in the classroom, the teachers are providing students with multiple opportunities to use language as a means for thinking and working together. Instead of teachers lecturing for a full period, students now have the opportunity to engage in collaborative group discussions where they share knowledge and they acquire a deeper learning and understanding of the topic. Three major transitions have occurred in our district due to the infusion of standards in our classrooms. The first is the common units at the middle schools. The middle schools worked on structure and consistency between the sites by creating common units for 7th and 8th grade. These units were teacher-created, aligned with the Common Core and ELD standards, and have SBAC-aligned assessments. This is our first year to present the units to our students, and on January 26, as Mr. Robinette mentioned, we have the opportunity to meet and participate in a very rich discussion about the units and the assessments. I'm very excited about the level of collaboration and the progress that we've made since we began working on these units in April. We have moved away from the primarily district-designed assessments to teacher-created Common Core and SBAC-aligned assessments that are being administered as a component of the common units at our middle schools. The high schools are also currently in the process of developing and administering site common assessments per grade level. Julie Adams, who's an international educational consultant, has been working with the middle school teachers last year and this year, providing them with training and coaching in the areas of implementation of the Common Core standards, critical thinking, and content area literacy and writing. As I mentioned, she is continuing to work with the middle school teachers, and she is also conducting training for the high school teachers this year. Another area of teacher learning is the ERWC. The middle school and high school teachers have been invited to participate in the ERWC trainings hosted by the Early Assessment Program Department at Cal Poly. The expository reading and writing course training focuses on presenting teachers with modules, which include a wide variety of nonfiction texts and literature that emphasizes the in-depth study of expository, analytical, and argumentative reading and writing. I'm very excited about the journey that we are on and very, very excited about where we're going. In previous years, many of our assessments and schoolwork were done with pen and paper. Our students are now using devices and technology as a tool for collaborating and for developing 21st century skills. Another tool are the SBAC interim online assessments. IABs, which are interim assessment block assessments, and ICAs, which are interim comprehension assessments, are now available to our students. These tests are designed to provide targeted information for teachers regarding student performance, and the secondary sites are looking at infusing these assessments into their instruction to better prepare students for the SBAC assessments that they'll be taking in the spring. This year, Illuminate has become an integral tool for the English teachers at the secondary level. Not only are all common assessment scores recorded in Illuminate, but teachers can effectively aggregate their students' results in a few steps, which provides them with immediate information to inform their instruction. This data is also referenced when teachers engage in collaborative discussions about the assessments. The high schools are in the process of developing common assessments for each grade level that will be administered to students at both high schools next year. This will provide the teachers with the opportunity to further align their curriculum with the standards, to reach a consensus on instruction and assessment, to acquire important information for differentiating instruction, and to facilitate discussions about the assessments as well as student scores.
Good evening. I'm going to follow Sandra's lead and first talk about English language development in a Common Core world and shifts we've gone through, give you a little bit of a picture of where we've been over the last year, and then I'll go into where we're going with English language development. So I wanted to start with a couple of visuals and start by really touching on where we were in ELD under the prior standards. And when I say we, it's sort of the collective we statewide. But really, ELD was a separate subject. We've talked about this before when I've been up in front of you. And students had access to curriculum, but content teachers didn't necessarily teach language, right? You were a math teacher, an English teacher. ELD was definitely separate, and there were prescribed minutes. And where we're moving towards under the new standards is what we call integrated and designated ELD. So when you see the large blue circle, that's encompassing what we're calling integrated ELD. And so an example of this is a recent science lesson. I was working with our science TOSA, who's developing model lessons, and he was working with the teacher to have students evaluate each other's work in writing. So they had done a bunch of work, and then they were writing their thoughts about each other's work on stickies. And so in addition to talking about what it means to evaluate work in the arena of science, they also focused on the language of evaluation. They taught students the phrasing, then provided students that phrasing so that when students were writing their evaluations, they had that language that they could use. So that would be integrated ELD. In the arena of designated ELD, you'll note on the slide that there's little arrows pointing to that middle circle now, because designated ELD needs to be connected to all of the content areas. So an accompanying designated ELD lesson that could go with that science lesson would be students who are learning English really focusing before that science lesson on vocabulary, on using nouns and verbs, on connecting and condensing their ideas, so that they would be ready for that discussion in science. So we're really shifting away from this model of ELD as isolated towards a model of ELD as connected. So what that has meant in San Luis Coastal is a few different shifts that we've been looking at. I'll start with instructional shifts and then talk about model shifts that we've been focused on. Instructionally, we've been, over the past year, really looking at three areas. So what are the new ELD standards? How are they structured? What do they mean? Where are we trying to get students to so that they're college and career ready? We've also been looking at new language levels. And so when I was here, I think in November, I talked about CELT levels 1 through 5. I provided you some data on that. And those levels are shifting. So rather than thinking about students as a CELT 1, we're shifting towards where is a student's language proficiency in terms of emerging language, expanding language, or bridging language. And so for our ELD teachers and our content teachers, starting to learn about what those language proficiency levels mean and how to strategically provide support for each of those levels within the content areas in the integrated setting and in designated ELD. So we've done a lot of work to begin learning about what this means. And then we've also been focused on student conversations. And so we don't want our students to feel like they're at an LCAP symposium all day, right? We want our students interacting, and you heard what Sandra said about the importance of academic vocabulary or academic language, tier 1, tier 2, and tier 3 vocabulary, the importance of speaking and listening. So in August, I worked with all teachers district-wide on structures to engage students in conversation. I worked specifically with our English and math teachers in the PDs that Mr. Robinette just referenced. I'll be working with our ELD teachers this week to really keep this focus on getting students engaged in conversation for the purpose of experimenting and using language so they can grow in their academic language skills. In terms of our models, we've sort of been thinking about three areas, the first being in-class support. And so at a couple secondary sites, we've been piloting having the ELD teacher actually work in tandem with the content area teacher. And so an example of this was a recent lesson where the ELD teacher actually went into the ELA classroom when students were working on writing resumes and specifically supported English learners with the vocabulary they needed in their resume writing. And we have a couple of models like that, one in ELA and then one where a teacher pushes into math, because we know from our CPM curriculum and the shifts in mathematics how language-rich our math is now. We've also talked about the targeted pullout. When I was here in November, I referenced the reading classes that we have for our English learners, and then the long-term English learner support, and thinking about programming for our newcomers. So rather than every single English learner being pulled out just because they're an English learner, looking at how to target that support. And then increasing our alignment, meaning what we're doing with ELD and how it's aligning with ELA or other content areas in terms of common assessments, like Sandra was talking about, our common units, and where is our instructional alignment. So where we're going is still this focus on English learners learning content, grade level content, while they're also learning English. And we're really focused on developing the capacity of all of our teachers.
It's okay, Don. I just want to understand the designated ELD component from that previous slide. Is
way
the
back.
Subject matter teacher providing that ELD assistance, or is that where you're using the model shifts, in-class support, targeted pullout, or increased alignment? Or is there some other answer? So who provides the designated ELD and the various subject domains?
Yeah, so that's a complicated question, because it's been a shift in our standards away from a time, a place, and a person to a service. So students need to receive designated ELD. They could receive it from the ELD teacher, but they could receive it from our content area teachers, depending on the school and the student's needs and the situation. And so that's one of the things we've been looking at, is what is the best way to provide designated ELD at our secondary sites. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So it sounds like it's a bit of a work in progress and somewhat tailored to the individual student.
I think statewide, we're trying to really take a look at what does this mean to no longer have a time, a place, and a person that's attached, and what do we do in terms of that service? So it is a bit of a work in progress, but I wouldn't want people to think that all of a sudden our students aren't getting ELD, because they're definitely getting ELD still. But we're kind of looking at revamping how do we ensure that connection with the content areas. Does that make sense? Okay. I'm sure I'll be back. But this kind of speaks to your question in terms of developing capacity. So how we develop the capacity of all of our content area teachers as well as our ELD teachers in understanding integrated and designated ELD. Where we're going is also increasing consistency. So thinking about students at one site receiving in-kind programming if they were to move to another site, and what that looks like for all of our secondary sites. And then, of course, using data. So we just got our first SBAC results. We shared some of those with you. We'll be moving from the CELT to a new assessment called the LPAC, which is the English language, English Language Performance Assessments of California. English Language Proficiency Assessments of California, and so looking at how we use that data when it comes out. But also I want to reference what Sandra said about common assessments and how we use our own common assessment to really pinpoint the needs of our English learners and how to support them strategically. So with that, you want me to click?
Sure, keep on clicking. Great, so in summary, just kind of what are the main points to remember from this as we walk away? In English language arts for secondary, we're really looking at working with our teachers collaboratively to develop common units so that there's a commonality across a grade level, that they're teaching similar standards with similar assessments so that they may then have in-depth professional conversations around students that are struggling, are achieving at a high level, and what they can do about it. The next piece is using evidence. So as Sandra mentioned, it's a big shift. Right? It's a big shift from tell us about something you enjoyed over the summer to reading these two articles, using evidence from it to support your answer. Right? So that's a big shift. And collaboration. So using our time effectively with teachers in order to let them work as professionals to help one another to develop even further. And then with English language development, it's really, Walt kind of hit on it, it's connecting that grade level content within content area classes with language and how teachers can utilize time within content classes to continue to develop students' academic language. So there's the two main areas we were discussing today, and feel free to ask any questions.
If I got Mr. Unger.
So I have two questions for you. One of the concerns that people have expressed about the Common Core is that students will no longer be reading fiction. And I think that's probably a fiction. But could you address that, please, and talk about the place of fiction in high school English? And, you know, actually, I suppose, given the model we're talking about, it could be history, you know,
exactly,
things like that.
Yeah,
I mean,
think
I guess you could read Killer Angels in your history class when you're studying Civil War and things like that.
Exactly. I think that's the point. When you look at what Common Core calls for, you hear 70% of what a student reads is nonfiction. But what you just hit, Chris, doesn't mean within one English class that 70% of what they're reading is nonfiction. That means throughout their school experience. So that includes science, social science, career tech electives. So you think about manuals that kids might be reading, nonfiction related to their welding class, right? So that can, you think about within an English class, it's much more balanced, more 50-50-ish. But overall, throughout all content areas, there is a shift towards nonfiction when you consider their entire experience.
So it's probably really not as much of a shift as it appears to be, because students were reading nonfiction in non-English classes anyway. Is that kind of what you're telling me?
I think you're right. I think the shift within English probably isn't as strong. However, there are literacy standards within Common Core that are for science, social science, and career tech electives, and that is a shift.
Wow.
So it can't be that you're only going to write a beautifully written paragraph when you're in English.
Right.
Instead, it's when you're writing within a history class, you're still going to write a beautifully written paragraph that we have now have a common understanding about what's expected of you.
Well, I think that integration is one of the really positive things about the Common Core. The second question, thinking about our common assessments, and I know we've been working on that for a long time, and I think that's great. Are we using the same common assessment at Los Osos Middle School as we are at Laguna, or is it site, or are the common assessments looking more site-based?
Yeah, feel free to jump in, Sandra. But we have worked, the middle schools, I would say, we did so much incredible work last year on making unified assessments that work for all 7th graders, no matter what site you are at, as well as 8th grade. And we're continuing looking now at that information, and the teachers really working together. I think they did a lot of amazing collaborative work last year around that area.
So it makes me think of another question. Since the middle school program at Los Osos Middle School looks different than the middle school program, the sixth grade program at Los Osos Middle School looks different from the sixth grade program in town. How are we coming with common assessments for that?
Right. What we landed on is that you are, when you're in seventh grade English at Los Osos, you have seventh grade standards that are the same as your seventh grade standards right. at Laguna. And so what we decided on is there are, what we came up with last year, four common units, but that does not dictate your entire teaching curriculum. It's just four units within. So there's still flexibility within the other portions to say, how are you going to cover these standards in a more integrated way, or with STEAM incorporated, et cetera. So it doesn't map out the entire 180 days, but it does say let's have these four common elements at least.
And that would be the same, say, at Bishop's Peak as it is at Los Osos Middle School. Sixth grade in town versus sixth grade here as well.
I see what you're saying. There are differences, I would say. I don't know, Amy, if there's a...
Mrs. Shields. Aha!
It's a similar answer in that you still okay. have the same standards, right? But how those address maybe look
different. They're probably delivered differently.
But we do have some common assessments in place currently in writing.
Okay.
For all sixth graders take the same writing assessment. All sixth graders, this is an ELA presentation, but all sixth graders take the same math common assessment no matter what school they go to.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Let me go to the public, Mark, just because I... Was there anyone from the public who would like to address this item? Okay, seeing none, Mr. Buckman?
Thank you. So I understand common assessments are still there, and I want to be sure I heard this, but were teachers more and more doing their own assessments within their classrooms?
I think what Sandra was commenting on is that teachers worked collaboratively together. So seventh grade teachers across Los Osos and Laguna worked together to say, how can we agree upon a seventh grade assessment? So it was teacher created, and that what we were trying to get to is that this is an embedded assessment that you believe in, that you value, and that you will do something with afterwards, not something that Kim had magically show up that you don't have an investment and a buy-in to.
So thank you for it was the teacher created that was.
There you go. Yep.
And, okay. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Okay, then my questions, I guess, are for Mrs. DelMartini. Could you explain a little more about the ERWC articulation with Cal Poly?
ERWC is a program that infuses literature as well as an emphasis with nonfiction. So depending on the level, you have middle school ERWC all the way up through high school. And at the middle school level, it's more looking at nonfiction, looking at, as Mrs. McGrath was saying, looking at manuals, looking at text, looking at advertisements, reading articles. For example, there's a unit on tap versus bottled water, and you look at the pros and the cons of both of those. And then the students have to synthesize all that information. And the expository reading and writing units, the modules are created. It's actually a partnership with the CSUs.
Okay.
And so they are very, very popular at the high school level. And they're actually taught at some of the high schools in place of 12th grade English. The students can take the ERWC module class. But they were so popular at that level, they've moved them down to the middle school level. So all of the modules are created by the CSUs, and they are the ones who then provide the training for the middle school and the high school teachers. And there is always a representative from a university. For example, we have a training that went on yesterday and today, and there was a representative from Channel Islands University who presented the training. And through our partnership with Cal Poly, we learn about the trainings in our area.
I see. Okay, and is it enjoying the same popularity at the middle school that it did at the high school level?
Yes. It is. Because the modules are very engaging. And so the more the teachers have that opportunity to present the module to the students and the students get excited about them and then talk to their peers about it, then it interests more teachers in wanting to be a part of the program as well. And you must, to be able to have access to the online professional training as well as the modules, you have to go through the 3-day training or the 4-day training, depending on whether it's during the school year or during the summer.
And that's something that we provide based on interest.
Yes, yes. So if you are a high school teacher, the training is provided to you at no cost other than your guest teacher. So there are two summer days And then there is a day in September and one in October where we would be paying for a guest teacher. But the universities, the CSUs, are paying for the registration. They're not doing that for the middle schools. Middle schools, we do have to pay not only for our guest teachers, but also pay for our registration fee as well.
That's an interesting program.
It's very interesting, yes. Very engaging.
Yeah, it sounds... At first, I've heard of it, and so I'm so glad you brought it up. And then the other question I had was the SBAC interim assessments.
Yes, ma'am.
Is that something that's student-driven or teacher-driven?
It's teacher-driven in the sense that there are now... Are you speaking of the IABs and the ICAs? Okay.
Thank you, Mrs. McGrath. Why I am.
So part of what is now available to us, which is I find really very valuable, is the opportunity for our students to participate in taking the IABs, which are interim assessment block tests. You do take them on a device, and they mimic the SBAC test. And so for ELA, there are approximately half a dozen of them. And they range from listening and speaking to revising, editing, reading text, reading literature, and, you know, responding to questions. And the IABs are anywhere from 15 to 25 questions, and they're multiple choice as well as a short response, constructed response. And they are then taken on a device by the student, and then when the teacher receives the data, he can then inform his instruction based on how the student has done. Because the IABs are very specific in an area. You know, we're looking for a specific area of diagnosis. If you want to take the ICA, that's the interim comprehensive assessment, and that's basically you're taking the SBAC test. It's a summative assessment. It's not formative. It's a summative assessment. And it once again provides the teacher with very valuable information as to how well the students are going to perform when they take the SBAC in the spring. They're all forms of formative assessment, which is really now what we're asking the teachers to infuse in the curriculum. Because the more formative assessment, the better we can inform our instruction.
So these acronyms, I mean, I'm lost on those, but the former rather than the latter, both informs instruction and would serve to familiarize students with the process of the test taking in a smaller block.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the tests are a combination of either purely multiple choice, or they're multiple choice and short response, or some of them actually have a performance task, which is a full write, which means it's an essay that the students are, they read information, mm-hmm. they synthesize it, and then they respond to a prompt that they're given.
Okay, thank you for fleshing those out for me.
You're very welcome.
Mr. Unger.
Can I have two follow-up questions? I'm curious about the essay portion of the test you were just talking about. Who grades those?
They're teacher scored. They're hand scored.
Oh, so are they scored by our teachers?
They're scored by our teachers. Anything
okay.
that is multiple choice is machine scored.
Right.
By the SBAC, the Smarter Balance Consortium. They score, but everything that is a short response or a full essay, those are hand-scored by the teachers themselves.
Okay, and so the teachers are aware, hopefully aware of the rubrics that the SBAC's scorers are going to be using when the student takes the test for real.
Absolutely, and I mentioned to you that we are using common assessments at the middle
right.
school level, and also we have common assessments at the high school level, and the rubrics that are being utilized are the SBAC rubrics.
Okay.
Because we feel that it's very important. If these are the rubrics where our students are going to be judged when they take the test in the spring, these are definitely rubrics we need to be using in our classroom right now to familiarize the students with them.
And the second question I have is, how quickly are the results of the interim tests coming back to the teachers?
They're telling us that if it is, well, of course, it depends on the teacher. Because if it's a purely multiple choice test, the results are going to come back within 48 hours. But if it is the short response, the constructed response, or also the essay, what happens is a student takes the multiple choice aspect of the test, then the teacher, because it's taken on a device, the teacher accesses the student's responses, scores them, and then of course it's up to the teacher, you know, how many days it's going to take the teacher to score all of those responses, and then they're submitted to Smarter Balanced. And we're told that they should also come back within 48 hours as well, once the teachers have scored the hand section.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Thank you all very much for the presentation.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Item 10.2, an instructional coaching update. Mrs. Shields.
Good evening, Board. For my update tonight, and you do have a handout, but we will need it in a little bit, just with a couple things that I thought might be difficult for you to see up on the screen. Well, you can look at it if you'd like, but I'll wait till I've got your eye contact. For my update tonight, we're going to talk about instructional coaching in our elementary portion of San Luis Coastal. I'm going to provide you first with a brief history of how we got to our current instructional coaching model, as well as our vision. I'm going to introduce our coaches, one personally tonight, and the rest with the power of some slides, and describe their multiple roles out at our school sites. I'm going to share our focus this year in moving towards a student-centered coaching model. And finally, I'm going to finish up with some highlights of site-based coaching work. And since she's been here an hour and 15 minutes, I do want to introduce one of our coaches that is here with us tonight, Dara Stutzman, who is the instructional coach at Hawthorne Elementary School. So elementary instructional coaching began back in 2011 in San Luis Coastal and has been evolving ever since. Each site back then, 4.5 years ago, selected a full-time coach or teacher on special assignment with their role defined by the individual site. At the same time, we began developing our vision for our work with our coaches. So our second slide shows you that vision. I'm not going to read it to you, but I'll tell you what's most important about it is that it reflects the importance of a partnership between the coach and the teacher as well as with the site principal. In 2012, we developed a district coaching model based on the work of Jim Knight. 5 coaches were assigned to our 10 elementary sites. Ongoing training was provided for the coaches, but we found that as our coaches grew in their knowledge and their skills, it became pretty clear that having a traveling coach working at multiple sites was not the most effective model for making a positive impact on student achievement. And so we evolved. 2014-15 school year, we tweaked that model so coaches were assigned to just one school site, with the exception of Teach. They got a piece of one that also works at Los Ranchos. Oversight and supervision of our coaches was shifted from instructional services, me, back out to our site principals. In addition to coaching responsibilities, each of the coach was assigned to a teaching responsibility at their site. Having coaches work directly with students as part of their assignment, we feel has supported the partnership between coaches and classroom teachers, as well as provide needed intervention and EL support. The final piece of the puzzle was to have coaches partner with the principals to support site-based instructional and professional development needs. For the 15-16 school year, we have continued this model with part-time coaches serving our 10 elementary sites, and there they are. Sites have also made adjustments to that other half of their assignment. Some of our coaches are EL specialists, some of our coaches are intervention teachers, and 3 of our coaches are actually part-time classroom teachers. Our focus for the 2015-16 school year is around student-centered coaching. After completing a book study last spring, we invited the author of the book, Diane Sweeney, who you can see, I think she's wearing a white jacket in the middle there, is not one of our coaches, was our guest for a few days back in June. We learned more about what student-centered coaching actually was. We met with her, we met with our principals, and from there we committed to give it a try this year, really go forward getting student-centered coaching off and running as a focal point for our coaching program this year. So what is this student-centered coaching thing, you might ask? What does it look like? Well, I will tell you that the big idea behind student-centered coaching is that it is not about fixing people. It is not a deficit approach. Coaching is a partnership with our teachers. It's about student learning and student outcomes. When we use student-centered coaching as a practice, we look at student outcomes first, then we figure out what are the instructional practices to improve those outcomes for our students. Student-centered coaching includes 8 core practices. I'm not going to review them all with you tonight, but I do want to start with the very first one. The first one is about setting goals for the coaching cycle. What is it I, as a teacher, want my students to know and be able to do as a result of my time with the coach? The coach and the teacher sit down together and choose a just-right goal based either on our standards, the standards at their grade level, or possibly a behavior skill that they're working on in their classroom. From there, the teacher and the coach use student evidence to plan for instruction. So that they look at real data, real lifetime student work, to figure out where are our kids achieving now, what steps might we take to get them to the next level, and what are the things that we're going to do to get them there. So now you can look at your handout. I provided you with a sample of a coaching sample, which, as I was afraid of, would not show up well on this board here. So the teacher and coach would use this template to develop a plan for working with the students to meet that goal. What they do together may include co-teaching, model lessons, observation and feedback between the coach and the teacher. The coach and teacher agree to meet on a weekly basis, and sometimes even more, to assess student progress on that goal and plan for the next steps in the classroom. Your second handout, okay, Kim, if you will, please, shows you a completed coaching cycle. And at the end of a coach cycle, which usually lasts about 4 to 6 weeks, the teacher and the coach sit down together and measure the impact of coaching cycle on the student as well as on the teacher's learning. The purpose is not about accountability. It's about looking at student results and what made that impact. The goal is also for the teacher to continue the effective teaching moves after the coach is gone and moved on to work with another teacher. So how do we measure its effectiveness? It is about student achievement data. For example, if you look on that completed coaching cycle in front of you, you will see at the beginning of that coaching cycle, 3 out of 27 students in that particular classroom were able to meet writing proficiency on our narrative writing on-demand scores. By the end of the coaching cycle, which you can see there, involved weekly meetings, involved some co-teaching, some observation and feedback, I believe they reached 23 out of 27 students that had met that proficiency goal. And with a student-centered coaching cycle, we're able to actually measure results and then make a plan for further improvement. So, Kim, if you could take me back to my slide, and I may have pushed too forward. Perfect. So how's it going so far? During the first trimester of school, we completed 30 coaching cycles at our schools with either individual teachers or grade levels of teachers working with their coach. But let's hear a little bit more from our coaches about this process.
Here at Sinsheimer, when a teacher and I work together, what we mainly focus on at the beginning is a student-centered goal. So we talk about where students are based on evidence and data, and then through that conversation, we partner together to come up with a goal that will help drive our instruction and co-teaching practices throughout a coaching cycle. The neat part about coaching is that it's solely driven by student need, along with teacher choice. So what teachers want to do for their students in the classroom, they're able to do with a partner, which is rare because normally in our classrooms we're isolated in our bubbles. And so having this partner who can come in and offer new ideas and perspectives can be really valuable. Coaching provides an opportunity for teachers to have embedded professional development spiraling throughout the year. So rather than getting pulled out of our classrooms for one toe dip and learning about one tool that we might then bring back to our classrooms, we're able to continually work alongside with a partner, our coach, to see how we can work together and support our student growth. You can see here in this coaching cycle, we set a specific student learning goal, and all of our learning goals, as well as our instructional practices, are driven by questions along with the Danielson framework, which it's aligned to. Also, we have our standards down here at the bottom and the ELD framework, which supports how we create our instruction and also how we measure our students' objectives and the process to get them to meeting those objectives.
Coaching is very unique because it allows two professionals with student-centered goals in mind to dig deeply into the standards for that grade level, as well as really understand our curriculum, which has been changing rapidly in the last couple of years, so that two professionals can look into what our students need, where they are, and where they need to go to meet the standard. At Bishop's Peak, we do two different kinds of cycles. One would be informal, short-term, maybe more as a resource, and the second one is more formal with targeted students in mind, where it would be maybe from 4 to 6 weeks where we're looking at for a specific instructional goal. But the nice thing is with coaches being on site in their multiple roles, I can also be a resource later when some other questions come up.
We have seen a lot of benefit from student-centered coaching here at C.L. Smith. I think one of the biggest benefits is that student-centered coaching provides an opportunity for teachers to really sit down and work with a collaborator. And they're able, you know, to sit down with their coach, and they have that other eye in the classroom. The coach pushes in, and they're able to see everything that's happening that the teacher may not be seeing because they're involved in that lesson and they're involved in their students. And so bringing in that separate perspective then to take that student data and say, okay, let's work together. How are we going to pull out, you know, what the students are struggling with right now, and how are we going to focus on that in our lessons, has been a real benefit of student-centered coaching.
So I should have introduced them. That was Kayla Campa, in order of appearance, coach at Sinsheimer, Grace Washer, Bishop's Peak, and Jessica Miller at C.L. Smith. So a key component, I may need you to, thank you. There we go. Another key component is partnering with the principal. The principal needs to be there to support the work of our coaches, as well as partner in planning both site-based professional development and supervision at the school site. So equally as important is, what do our teachers think of coaching and the student-centered coaching approach? Let's hear from Maisha Schlusher and Cherie Newell from Baywood.
So here at Baywood, we have been fortunate to be participating in student-centered coaching, which initially when we first started out, we were thinking, wow, we're just going to be going after one standard when there are so many for us to attack and really make sure that our kids are knowing well. And much to our surprise, we've seen a lot of success in just seeing how going after one standard has really had this ripple effect in supporting our students in overall in their learning. In our student-centered coaching, we focused on sight words, and it was incredible to see for our students how they grew from our baseline data. We took midpoint data and end of the our goal data, and we're involving our students in the process of that and helping them to know what their goal was. And in learning so many of these words, their other areas of reading were really supported as well. Their reading level, their confidence in reading, and so there's just been a lot of really bonuses to being able to have this student-centered coaching.
And along with that, having the coaches come into our classroom, they really know our students. They walk us through, our coach walked us through the way that we would gather our information, also trained some parents and our student teachers in how to help us gather that data, as well as then how to start to really instruct the kids with sight words. And through that, they really were supported in moving from one level to the next level in reading. And the amount of growth that we saw was pretty phenomenal. And we were able to share that at our conferences. And the parents, we also included the parents as a part of our team.
The other piece that's been fantastic for us is not only with our coach's support, she was able to be here to support us when we needed her, and she's equipped other volunteers and our student teachers and us as well to be able to carry this out in the next trimester so that we're able to continue this process and help our students succeed.
And she helped us with all the materials we needed, so that also lightened the load. So it was not only coming in and helping us focus, but also letting us know that our coach was there to make sure that they could help us.
So in addition to student-centered coaching cycles, all coaches provide site-based professional development as well as district-level professional development. With the move towards site autonomy focus this year, each of the coaches has a unique role at their site in supporting teacher growth based on that site's focus. Here you see coaches supporting teacher growth with their thinking maps, close reading strategies, and developing integrated units, to name a few. In addition to all of this, the instructional coach is the go-to person at the site for resources, materials, classroom management ideas, best practices, and of course, new teacher support. As I mentioned earlier, the coaches are spending half of their time working directly with students, either as classroom teachers, EL specialists, or intervention teachers. As we move forward, we want to more fully develop our student-centered coaching model so that all teachers and therefore all students will reap the benefits of working with a coach to increase student academic performance. Our coaches are unique, incredible teachers who are making a positive impact on student achievement in each of our elementary school sites. Any questions?
Mrs. Sheffer.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Millar.
Let me first go to the public.
Certainly.
Is there anyone from the public that has any questions? Please. Could you come to the microphone?
So I really love this idea, actually, or process that's happening, but how difficult would this be to implement in other schools, like middle schools and high schools?
I think conceptually you could definitely implement it at any level, because anytime you have professionals working together to improve their practice, to work together to use data to analyze, to have quality conversations, you absolutely could. The trick comes then is that you have content-specific teachers, right? So you would need coaches at every content area. So we tend to focus on content support and instructional strategies being the part that tends to overlap throughout the content areas.
Thank you. Mrs. Sheffer.
I know that when we began the coaching concept at the schools that it took a little getting used to and some acceptance by the sites. Do you find that this is now becoming more accepted as the norm? This is how we do things?
I think we're on an evolution towards that. I think if I compare this year to last year, I think our coaches and our teachers have grown leaps and bounds in developing those kind of relationships. I think through the site base, the way we're doing it with the site base, where the coach is right there next to the teacher, not in front of the teacher, has children that they're responsible, is providing interventions, is providing EL specialists. They really are seen as a peer, a partner, and I think that has helped really open up the doors for them.
Do you find at all that because the coaches are such a valuable resource, that, I mean, I could see them being asked hundreds of questions and maybe perhaps pulled in many, many directions you're a coach. Did they have the appropriate support to be able to say, I'm not I don't know whether I'm going to be able to achieve or get to all the goals that have been set because I'm receiving so the needs are great or people are asking me to do things that I need to prioritize or how do I sort that out? I mean, I don't even know if that's what happens, but
I think it's a really fair question. I think part of what makes it doable is the closer they are able to partner with their principal as well as partner with me at Instructional Services. I meet with the coaches once a week, every Friday afternoon, for ongoing professional development for them, as well as sharing of ideas, planning district PD, learning what each of the coaches are doing at site so they can learn from each other and be a support to each other. That is their PLC time, where their professional learning community, where they come together and have that supportive environment. But I think the principals also play a key role in making sure that they can adjust and prioritize the work that they can get done because they are being asked in many, many directions.
Okay, thank you very much. I really appreciate the presentation.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mr. Unger.
So I wanted to compliment you. First of all, I think the road we've been traveling is the right road.
Thank you.
And I was talking to a school board member from Bakersfield this weekend who is also a retired principal, and she said one of the most positive things they've done in Bakersfield is to have coaches at their schools. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bakersfield, of course, is a high-poverty district and how helpful it's been. The second thing I wanted to compliment the staff on and you is the collaborative coaching cycle. Each of these descriptors talks about students.
Yeah.
And students are at the center of it. I just think that's phenomenal, and I really appreciate that. And then the other thing I was just kind of thinking about what you were saying. One would hope that, you know, as on the secondary level, things become more integrated, we can see that coaching model move toward the secondary schools as well, because it seems like it would be really valuable there, too, as we try to break down those silos. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments?
Thank you,
Mrs. Shields. So item 10.3 is a request to submit a general waiver presented by... Why, it's Mrs. Shields. Hello.
Good evening again. So the California Education Code specifies that each school district must certify the accuracy of the state testing apportionment information report for both CELT and the CASI. This report that we must submit to the state must be postmarked by December 31st. If we don't meet that deadline, which I'm here to say we didn't meet that deadline, we must submit a general waiver in order to obtain the state testing apportionment funds, of which will be slightly less than $5,000. So I'm here to request that tonight.
Okay, does anyone from the audience have any questions about this waiver? Seeing no one, we'll bring it back to the board. Mr. Millar?
Mrs. Shields, so the CASI isn't being used anymore. This is monies from previous iterations of when we were using the CASI?
Correct.
And it has to do with funds that the state provides to support those two tests specifically?
And they're to support the administration costs of giving those assessments, and we do get it a year behind. So this will be our last year receiving CASI funds.
And we did appropriately account for the apportionment of the monies. It just was a timing problem.
That is correct.
Okay, good. I'll move approval of the general waiver.
A motion by Mr. Millar and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. Those in favor? Oh, I beg your pardon. Mr. Quessenberry.
Mr. Millar moves very quickly.
and now my microphone is working very... No, I was just want to confirm that We did administer the CELT, as we always do, early in the school term, and it's just a matter of getting the paperwork. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. It is a paperwork to the state follow-up report that was not postmarked by December 31st.
I'm happy with that answer. So we can proceed, I guess.
Okay. So then we're still acting under a motion by Mr. Millar and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. Those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you.
That's 7-0. Oh, I beg your pardon. 6-0 and one abstention. Now, we have several ratifications. These all need to be done individually, I guess. Mrs. Holmes? Okay. Item 10.4 is an item to ratify the revised 2015-2016 tentative agreement with California State Employees Association.
So if you recall, last year we agreed with our various associations that we would return to the table if our property taxes exceeded 5%. So this agreement is our agreement with CSEA, in which Dr. Eisendrath Rogers was a part of this negotiating this day that when we negotiated this tentative agreement. This tentative agreement is with CSEA, and it involves, in addition to salary, a 2% increase retroactive to July. It also includes other items of interest. There is a section on association rights. There is a court case going through the Supreme Court called Friedrichs versus the California Teachers Association that may alter the agency fees that are collected from union members. And so in an effort to get in front of their employees and teach their employees about the benefits of union membership. A lot of unions are asking to have something like this provision in here, which is asking that they have an opportunity to speak to their members from the beginning of their employment. The next section was about evaluations. We eliminated the 1-month evaluation. We had a 1, a 3, and a 6-month evaluation. Now we'll have a 2, a 2nd, and a 5th month evaluation. We also increased professional growth, and we have the terms of the agreement that now go through 2018. So those were the changes that were made to the CSEA agreement, and it has been voted on by the members. So that's what's being brought before you.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone who wishes to speak to the ratification of this tentative agreement? Seeing no one from the public, is there anyone from the board?
I have a question.
Mr. Millar.
So is that why this is a ratification on our part, because it's already been voted on by the membership of the
Correct.
Bargaining unit?
They've already voted, so now you're just finalizing it.
Okay, great. Shall I do the thing?
Guess you better.
I'll move ratification of the 2015-2016 tentative agreement with CSEA.
I'll second.
We have a motion by Mr. Millar and a second by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
I need to abstain. I was here for the discussion. Thank you.
Okay, so we have 6 ayes and 1 abstention. Next, item 10.5. Ratify a revised 2015-16 tentative agreement with the Service Employees International Union.
So unlike CSEA, it's the same circumstance in which we agreed to come back to the table for this year if our property taxes exceeded 5%. And because they did, we had discussions with SEIU, but rather than coming back to the table and having a full negotiating session and talking about other items, they were only interested in talking about the salary piece. So this is only the 2% salary increase retroactive to July 1st. And then you will be seeing in the next few meetings at some point the interests from SEIU. Tonight you presented your interests, so we're ready to go, but SEIU is still doing surveys to its members and figuring out what its members are interested in order to start negotiations for a successor agreement.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to the SEIU ratification? Seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board.
I'd like to move approval of item 10.05.
I'll second that.
So I have a motion by Mr. Unger, a second by Mr. Questenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. Item 10.06 is to approve the revised 2015-2016 agreement with confidential employees.
So based on those increased property taxes, we did go discuss with our confidential employees a similar increase to their salary that the other units had received. And so we are recommending a 2% salary increase retroactive to July 1st for our confidential employees and the salary schedules attached.
Okay, is there anyone from the public who would like to speak to the revised agreement with the confidential employees? Seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board. Mr. Questenberry?
This is just a question for general interest and for the public, my personal interest in the public, I hope. For me, it's the first time I've actually seen the salary schedule for the confidential employees, This is all available on our website, including the salary schedules for the various SEIU, CSEA, and the Teachers Association also.
And our management employees, including the superintendent, assistant superintendents.
Great. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Sheffer?
If there's no further discussion, I'd like to make a motion to approve the revised 2015-16 agreement with confidential employees.
Okay, I have a motion by Mrs. Sheffer, a second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 7-0. Item 10.07, approve revised 2015-16 agreement with Management Educators Council.
And our last group of employees is what we refer to as MEC, our Management Educators Council, and so we are recommending the same 2% increase retroactive to July 1st for that group of employees.
Is there anyone from the public who cares to comment on the revised agreement with MEC? Seeing no one, I'll bring it back to the board. I'll move approval of item 10.07.
I'll second that.
A motion by myself and a second by Mr. Questenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 7-0.
Thank you.
Item 10.08 is approved revised 2015-2016 salary adjustments for superintendent and assistant superintendents.
Yes, given the revised schedules with the other employee groups, I am requesting the board's consideration for the same be given to the executive group for the district.
Okay. Is there anyone in the public who would like to comment on the proposed revised salary adjustments for superintendent and assistant superintendents? Seeing no one, bring it back to the board. Okay, I have a motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Buckman. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That passes 7-0. Item 10.10 is approval to post E-rate Form 470 for equipment and installation for district-wide internet expansion. Mrs. McGrath.
Yes, thank you. So as you may remember, we have E-rate federal funding that is adjusted from long-distance cell phones, some internet, to almost primarily broadband support. So currently we're eligible for about $1.1 million of E-rate funding. What we can do is we can apply for equipment and installation related to broadband for our schools and receive about a 60% discount reimbursement from federal government. So because this is a large item, we thought we should bring that forward. So we're looking at asking for equipment, approximately $350,000, so the district's expenditure would be in the $150,000 range. So I ask for your approval to submit that form.
Okay. Is there anyone from the public who would like to comment? Seeing no one, Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I'm dealing with tech staff for all of some issues and the incredible work that's being done. The board regularly seems like they're replacing drivers and things within the data center. Are there specific items that you're going for? More of an improvement or things that would set us up for future improvement?
Absolutely. Some of it is new equipment needed. As we've expanded Wi-Fi into elementary schools, middle schools, now headed towards the high schools, it requires, you know, a backbone and a, you know, the server room that's supporting all that to also be expanded. So as we expand into the service, we kind of have to expand into what can support that. So that is one piece of that. Other than that, it's kind of like, I think of it like deferred maintenance also. It's a piece that we have to continue to maintain as servers age, as controllers, switches, other devices age. We just have to also continue to update those. And fortunately for us, anything related to broadband Wi-Fi now has this federal ability to be reimbursed for 60% of that.
And so within the district, I think the previous board members and staff have always sort of taught us that we should have a sinking fund so that if the computers need to be replaced in the future or repaired, we're ready for that. Is there any ability to use this money for maintaining that data center if things were to change or go down?
I think I understand your question. Let me know if I answer it properly. So we do have a replacement budget that we utilize each year for individual devices, and we use some of that as well to update equipment that's needed to support those devices. So that is in place currently that we receive each year that's district supported.
Okay, so this would not be something to supplement that at all?
This is equipment and installation above and beyond that to support just the broadband side of things.
Thank you.
Okay, well, then I'll move approval of approval to post the E-rate Form 470 for equipment and installation for district-wide internet expansion.
I'll second that.
So we have a motion by myself and second by Mr. Quessenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So that passes 7-0. Okay, you know, I just would remind the audience that we have coffee here and available for anyone who, for whom it's not too late, such as myself. It's there for your consumption if you're interested. Okay, item 10.11. Approval to pay board member salary for permissible absence.
Yes, we're
Mrs. Holmes. Dr. Frank.
Yeah, so we're requesting that the board approve the absence of Mrs. Sheffer at the January 22nd study session, as she was on the planning team for the CSBA annual conference planning team that she's on. Does that make sense? Poor language, but...
And she was required to be in Sacramento.
She was required to be there, yes.
Okay. Mr. Millar.
I would move approval of the pay in lieu of board absence.
I'm sorry, I was going to say, as the cause of this question, I will say...
So do you want to defer?
I'll give it to
you. So I have a motion by Mr. Millar, a second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes 7-0. Oh, I beg your pardon. Well, yes, you can. It's a great debate down here.
Is it 7-0?
Yeah. Okay, 7-0. Item 10.12, Measure D, approve architectural contract for the Teach Elementary School modernization.
Yeah, so KBZ Architects, when we first opened Teach, helped us in terms of the initial projects of the asphalt and getting classrooms ready and established to open school at the Grand Avenue site. And so our goal is to kind of complete that project. So there's still some things that we need to get accomplished. Those things include fire alarm, site accessibility issues, fencing around the campus. We're also looking at a shade structure because they kind of have their own lunch area where the Teach students eat. They have a shade structure for Sloca on the other end of campus, so something for Teach. Because when it doesn't rain, they do like to eat outside and like to be over by the classroom area. As well as kind of the key project is completing the restroom renovation, which is in kind of the main hallway next to Teach. And so taking the two current restrooms as well as two storage rooms and turning that into four restrooms for the students. So that's what this architecture contract it ties into. I've been worked with Mr. Holcomb. This is the same base architect agreement that we established through DWK that you've seen before with our other design bid build projects.
Okay, thank you. Is there anyone from the public that, sir?
Hello again. Just a quick question in reference to the added fencing needs. So I actually live adjacent to Teach Elementary, and so there's a beautiful walking path alongside the school that I use daily to get to school. Thank you. My only question is that will that be available in the future for people to continue to use?
Great question. So we actually purposely put that path so that students could transgress from Cal Poly back and forth and wouldn't have to physically go onto campus. So I think it's worked out great, and we absolutely plan on keeping that path right where it is. So it's been working out, I think, excellent.
And it's my understanding that it's going to become a toll road, and it's going to be 25.
Yeah. Only when times get tight, right? No.
Okay, so anyone on the board, do we have any board questions or comment on Teach renovations? I'll entertain a motion.
I'll move approval of Measure 10.12. Made of item number 10.12, sorry.
I'll second that.
Okay, so we have a motion by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers, second by Mr. Questenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? That passes 7-0. The next item, don't sit down, Mr. Pinkerton.
I'm not leaving.
Is item 10.13, Measure D, approve the contract for bridging documents for Morro Bay High School and San Luis Obispo High School.
So also working with DWK, the firm that we worked on for really with a lot of our Measure D projects along with the architect contracts, we did put together a contract for bridging documents. Very different in that we're really kind of taking a snippet out of the entire architect agreement, you know, the different phases that we talked about from design, bid, construction, where the architect would be part of that. Well, this is taking our current kind of site plans from that level and really getting them all the way almost to a design document level so that we can have something to put our RFP together when we go out to find a design build entity to complete the design build projects at both of our comprehensive high schools. So what we did was, this is an RFQ process. It's not, you don't have to bid it out to everybody, but we did. We took kind of the top firms that came out of our initial architect interviews with the district back about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, as well as looked at a couple of outside firms because we knew that whoever does the bridging document work cannot be part of the design build entities. So it kind of takes them out of the running of being part of that construction team and doing any of those work. So in working with Mr. Holcomb, did find a couple of firms and kind of sent the RFQ out to them as well, just to kind of see, because we didn't know if the local firms were going to bid, if they were going to come back with quotes or not. We had one firm out of the six that we'd sent the RFQ out to that came back with a kind of a request for qualifications in their proposal. Fortunately, it's a firm that, and kind of the one key architect is somebody that we know has done a lot of K-12 work. In talking with them, going through the sites, walking Morro Bay, walking with San Luis, feel like they're going to be a great team for us and really have the capabilities of getting this accomplished in a really short window. Because what we're asking them to do from tomorrow until probably June 15th, we hope to bring that document to the board, is that we're going to have a complete set of bridging documents, one for Morro Bay High School, one for San Luis Obispo High School. In terms of developing a fee, we did work with them. We took kind of the scale that we'd use for the other architects and really pulled out those sections. So we literally went through all of the projects and kind of discussed, okay, are we going to go all the way to schematics? Are we going to go to design development? And each one of the projects looked at the cost associated with that based on our kind of former fee structure and came up with a price that we felt was fair, that met our needs, and because you don't want to pay them too much because you're going to have to pay it in terms of the design build entity to take it from that design document through DSA through the phases. So that all of those dialogues, discussions kind of with Mr. Holcomb, went through, worked with Deidre Sakai from DWK, putting the document together, and then really sitting down with the architects, going through, making sure we had everything in order. And I think Mr. Holcomb can attest that we feel like we have a pretty good contract that's going to get us where we need to go by June. Anything I missed, Mr. Holcomb?
Okay, is there anyone from the public who would like to comment on this item? Seeing no one, I'll bring it back.
Move approval.
I have a question.
I'm sorry?
I think we have questions. Mr. Millar and then Dr. Eisengrath Rogers.
Thank you. Normally we don't have anybody from the public asking us questions. Great questions, by the way. This contract allows us to keep working with Pratt in massaging the bridging documents because they're critical to the design build entity and getting the product that we want.
So this is our big chance that to put together a document that we feel kind of exemplifies what we want those projects to look like. Because, again, with design build, once you've handed over those docs, it's not that you completely lose control over it, but you're allowing them to kind of take that idea and run with it, per se. So we're still involved. We'll still have check-ins, but we really need to make sure that we get everything into this document. Because anything after the fact becomes almost like a change order, where you're changing something, you're changing a project, you're changing an idea. So we really want to make sure we get this right. So there's different stages. So they'll be coming back to us. We have two kind of key dates. One will be kind of at the schematic design phase, where they'll come back, they'll show us kind of their work with all the projects that they have. We're probably at that point going to do a cost estimate to see how that fits within our general overview of our budget, because that's the time where we can make some decisions about things we need to cut or add or go forward. And then, again, we've gone through, both Mr. Palazzo, Mr. Holcomb, every single project, and that's maybe one where we can leave it at schematic design, but for the other ones, like the 100 building at San Luis Obispo High School, we're going to want to go all the way to design docs. We got a kitchen, library. I mean, there's just a lot of things we want to make sure that we have our imprint on that design stamp. And so all of that's been kind of articulated throughout this document, and we'll be following up with them, you know, throughout the way. And, you know, the big key is that we've got to get the staff input. So we need to start now, start meeting with the kitchen staff and teachers and librarians and everybody, because they leave in June. So this is really it's a good time in that we can kind of have them as part of that dialogue and decision base.
And this firm has experience producing bridging documents for design build entities for other similar public projects.
Yes, they do. The principal of the firm, Paul Pratt, has extensive OSHPD or hospital experience putting together design build documents. and bridging documents for those for those projects. The project architect, who we'll see the most of, has extensive K-12 experience in this area, all the way north to Sacramento, and I've actually dealt with the particular project architect before very successfully.
Good. That's good. That's reassuring. And I will go ahead and turn it over to Ms. Buckman.
No, I believe Dr. Eisendrath Rogers was next.
I just want to thank you both for the very thorough study session we had on this subject. I felt very comfortable with this bridging document. And I would just wanted to make a non-disclosure disclosure here that one of the many names that I go by is Pratt. It is my professional writing name and also my maiden name, but I am not related to, nor have I ever met, Mr. Pratt.
Good clarification.
He's a great guy.
Good clarification.
Yes. But I don't have to recuse because I have no connection to him whatsoever.
Okay, Mr. Buckman.
Without interrupting my fellow board members, I'd like to make a motion to approve this item.
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion by Mr. Buckman, a second by Mr. Questenberry, and I just would add the comment that I'm very appreciative of the in-depth education that we got in January at the study session about bridging documents. I too feel very comfortable with the presentation that was made to us.
And I will say, too, our goal would be to bring, like at that schematic design phase, to bring that to the study session for the board, let you get a good look at it, wrap yourselves around it, and know where we're headed and throughout that process over the next five months.
Okay.
A procedural question.
Yes.
Can we approve both contracts at the same time? Okay. Good.
So we have a motion by Mr. Buckman, a second by Mr. Questenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? That passes 7-0.
So the other thing I'll let the board just know, kind of as a closing, we are going to put together kind of a public symposium about design build. So hopefully for architects, for contractors in the area to kind of bring them in, let them know kind of what we're doing, what the plan is, because we do, you know, we want to have people with that RFQ, RFP when we go out for design build entity. We don't want to have just one firm. So we want to make sure kind of the public knows about what we're doing, where we're headed, and hopefully can make those arrangements to work together, and we'll get some really solid contractors and architects as we move forward.
Some local participants.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well, time is of the essence, we were told, so you need to get on your camel and ride. Okay.
Madam.
Moving on to the action consent agenda. Oh, Mr. Questenberry.
Okay, I just wanted to get clarification that that vote was for both.
Yes.
Both documents, and that was offered as a friendly amendment to the original motion. Is that
no? Mr. Millar questioned whether we had the ability to approve both documents in one item, and was told that we did.
It was my intent to approve both.
The recommendation in the agenda item presented to you is one motion to approve both contracts.
Okay. Yes.
You're good.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on to the action consent agenda. Please let me know if you'd like anything to be pulled. 11.01, approval of certificated and classified personnel items. 11.02, disposition of surplus property. 11.03, acceptance of donations. 11.04, approval of furniture and equipment requests. 11.05, approval of warrants and payroll. Okay, so I'm looking for a motion to approve 11.1, 2, no, 1, 3, and 4.
I move approval of action consent agenda as 11.01, 11.03, and 11.04.
And okay, and we have a second by Mr. Millar. So a motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Millar. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. Mrs. Sheffer.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to have to do that again. Thank you. I just have a quick question. I see that two of the items under to be listed as disposition of surplus property or vehicles. And I'm curious about if
they say the value is $200 for one, $500 for another. If they are not purchased by anybody, do we donate those? Or, you know, I know there are several organizations that accept donated vehicles, and I know for a fact, having done this, that they do not have to be operative vehicles. So I'm wondering, how do we dispose of those?
I don't know if we've had the issue where we sell them. So it's something I can find out about and see. But I'm for the most part, we don't sell a lot of vehicles. That we've had a couple recently. The ones that are here, the truck, as we have some replacement vehicles now, we're really getting rid of some of our fleet that's in really bad shape. The two vans in particular, ones where the roofs were rusting out and became unsafe to drive. If there's a potential rollover or something like that, we actually replaced two vans at Morro Bay High School. And these were the two of those athletic vans. So we got them two new vans instead. And thus, you know, because they're unsafe, surplusing them. But I will find out and see. So if nobody purchases these through, I'll see what the ramifications are to be able to do something like that.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks.
Thank you, Ms. Millar. I would move approval of item 11.02.
Second.
Okay, motion by Mrs. Sheffer, second by Mr. Questenberry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. Mr. Millar.
I just pulled this for purposes of abstaining because it involves a payment to a firm where my wife is employed.
Okay, then I will move approval of 11.05. Motion by myself, second by Mr. Unger. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 6-0 with one abstention. So we're moving on then to advance agenda. Dr. Eisendrath Rogers.
I have a request for an advanced agenda item for a study session that could possibly be titled something like Culturally Proficient Leadership. The purpose of that study session would be to ask and answer questions such as, do we have equity issues in our district or in our school sites? What does unconscious bias look like? We may want to examine suspension and expulsion data of our minority students. We might ask the question of, does the practice that we have of open campuses at our high schools have unintended consequences for the very students that may need more support and shelter in some ways? And if cultural proficiency is our aim, how do our board policies and our practices support that?
If you're looking for a second, I'll second that.
Okay. Mrs. Sheffer.
Two comments. One, I would want to, if we're talking about our suspended and expelled students, I do not want to limit that to minority students. I think we should look at it for all students because we're talking about equity.
Yes, exactly.
And secondly, I would add that having attended the planning conference a week ago in Sacramento, that the issues of addressing perhaps, I can make no predictions or assumptions on what will happen, but having cultural bias issues and things of that nature addressed or on several people, the attendees' minds at that. So I think that is certainly something that we're hearing a lot about. So we could also have opportunities at CSBA in the winter to talk about that as well, just to gain more information. But.
Mr. Millar.
I'm not sure what it all means. I'd like to see a little more information about it as far as the study session is concerned. I think we can address the expulsion open campus. The open campus issue has already been addressed in the past, but so I'd like to see more information about what the study session would address.
Mr. Unger.
Yeah, I'm of the same mind as Mr. Millar. I'm not opposed to the study session, but what I believe our protocol is that we would make the recommendation to bring it forward for approval at the next meeting. I would ask that we follow that protocol so that we can see a more specific proposal before approving this as an advanced, before approving this as an advanced agenda item. So that would be my request on this motion.
Okay, Mr. Buckman. Oh, Mr. Buckman, okay.
I was just going to say I would be happy to flesh that out and bring that. In what form would you like that to be brought to you?
I think what I would ask is that we just have a more, I'd like to, I think for the administration, I think we need a more specific proposal, because what you're talking about is a huge subject and a huge and appropriate subject, but I think I'd like to see the administration have more guidance before we approve that. So I'm just asking that we bring it back, and I guess I would ask the administration specifically what they need, because it just seems to me that we've got to have, well, like as I said before, I think our protocol is such that, except in unusual circumstances, we want things to be able to come back for us for approval with more feedback, and that's all I'm asking for.
Okay, and I would add that this advanced agenda item is being jointly put forth by Dr. Eisendrath Rogers and myself, and we have discussed it in PLRC with our intent to put it to ask for it as an advanced agenda item with Dr. Prater. So I think that he is aware of the interstices of what we're talking about or what we were thinking. It appears to be supported by several other board members, so I'm happy to bring it back. We'll flesh it out and we'll bring it back at the next meeting.
I guess I'd like to see more specifically what the proposal is, so that I could have some feedback into it as well before it goes back to the before the administration comes back to us with it. So that's what I'm asking for.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just looking for some more specificity. I'm not opposed to the idea of it. For instance, what does unconscious bias look like mean? I don't know.
Well, that's what we'll find out. It's
well,
a term
I want to find
that's
out
being
a little bit more before I dedicated.
It's a term being used frequently these days, and
I
don't think I understand it totally myself. But there are books written about it, and apparently our administration has an understanding of what it means. So they'll be educating us, because okay. I can't educate you, Walter. I don't know.
All right. I may be uneducable.
That remains an option as well.
So, okay. I will accede to the wishes of the majority, as always.
So we'll bring it back at the next meeting.
That would be my request, to bring it back at the next meeting. And as you're doing this, I just would have a request. One of my interests is our expulsions and our expulsion rates and our expulsion profiles. So I would ask that be considered, please.
Absolutely. Mr. Buckman.
I think two that possibly fall under this, but they could obviously be handled in other ways. Liz Moore has just been put in charge of a large grant at the county office, looking at, I believe, ROP and CTE. ROP is making a comeback as a term in legislation, at least during the last session, and I believe it'll be coming back more during the next session. So I was hoping that we might possibly be able to get Liz Moore come and talk to us about the grant and what's coming up. So it's probably just not a study session, but hopefully a request for an advanced agenda item.
You're asking for a presentation at a board meeting?
Yes, thank you.
I'll support that.
I have no problem with that.
Yeah, I'll support that.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Secondly, this is probably a request for an advanced topic at Measure D. We've talked about classrooms of the future, and we are coming
fast approaching, and I think tonight even more stress was placed on it for some specifics before we get into these, let these contracts go for the design. And so I'm hoping we can get some discussion of how these new facilities, how these upgraded facilities, and what we're doing towards creating classrooms of the future within these. So in my very simplistic way to explain this, I think housing code right now requires an outlet on all four walls. And so, you know, what are we doing that's be different in a school? So might we have 10 outlets on a wall to handle more technology? So it's my very simplistic example of what I'm sort of hoping to learn. So standard. Okay, so let me try it this way, Marilyn, because you're.
I'm sorry.
You're my guide in.
Help me out here.
Yes, help me out. Are we coming up with tech standards for classrooms, and what might those look like? So, more like a Measure D probably study, in addition to a study.
Mr. Holcomb is responding, I think.
Well, I think Mr. Pinkerton can probably elaborate on it, but, you know, we have a model classroom project. We've also gone and looked at a lot of other advanced classrooms in other districts. So the code word for us is make sure we're prepped for anything and everything, because it's, like most things in education, it's an evolving model. So, but we will have some non-standard size classrooms, quite a few of them actually, to address those changing educational models. So, Ryan, you might want to add to that, but I think that covers it.
So, what I'm asking is that something we would pursue a little more in depth at a Measure D study session? And whether the board's interested or staff?
Yeah, absolutely. I think model classroom, I think you're going to get a big dose of it with the bridging documents.
Okay.
For both the classrooms at Solhi and Morro Bay High School, absolutely. But for sure, the need for electrical technology, mobility, all of those things are key for future classrooms.
Okay. And just lastly, I was listening tonight, and there was something in the Friday memo from, I think, a week ago about asking for an acronyms, and I think there was a misunderstanding. But I think tonight what I was asking for and what I'm hoping that we can ask for from staff, and I think not sure this will be too, but tonight I heard terms like ERUIC. ERWC, Marilyn mentioned to me once, Next Gen Math was a pilot at one of the school sites. Is that you discovered when you were at Monarch or somewhere? There was a program that you walked in on?
You'll have to refresh me.
It's okay. And then tonight, it's all right. Tonight I also heard Danielson mentioned, Jim Knight, and there was another author, and all of these are either pilot programs or programs that we've adopted. Some are sort of big umbrellas, and some are within classrooms. And what I'd like is, if possible, the ability for myself and maybe others to be able to talk to a parent and talk to a teacher from some level of intelligence. So, let's say Danielson, and then a two-sentence summary of what Danielson is, what's it being used for. So I'm really thinking this is probably a Friday focus, but I thought I'd bring it up here.
So. Okay. Dr. Prater?
Yeah, we've been talking about this inside the cabinet. So I think it's makes perfect sense. We are putting together a tremendous number of changes and programs and adoptions for curriculum, and it's hard to keep up with if you're not close to it. So this makes good sense. It could serve all of us well, along with the public, down the road. So it could be a growing, dynamic document as well. So Kim Holmes and I will work on the template, and then I will work with my team and put this together.
Okay, thank you. So then, moving on, we have reports by board members. Mr. Unger.
Sure, I got a couple of things. Just a kind of reminder to everybody that Read Across America is coming at the end of the month, and maybe some of you have gotten invitations from the schools. It's just a great, fun experience, and I would invite anybody who can to participate in that. From the CSBA news desk, we released our adequacy report last week, and actually 2 weeks ago, and I've been pretty involved in actually trying to explain it to the press and to people as it comes out. And I would like to thank Mr. Holcomb for the time that he spent with us this morning with Mrs. Sheffer and me. He spent about an hour going through the things that you guys talked about at the study session, and it was really, really helpful, and I really want to thank you, Ron, for that. And then the last thing, I don't usually talk about what I see in bathrooms at school sites, but there was a dispenser on the wall in the staff loo here at Los Osos Middle School, and Mr. Palazzo explained that it was sunscreen, and that we have sunscreen and dispensers now available at all of our campuses, in our custodial closets, so that anybody that's out in the sun working, our custodians, our groundskeepers, our irrigation guys, probably teachers, anybody can go in and get quick access to sunscreen. And I'd never seen that before. I'd never heard of it before, and I just think it's a great thing. So thank you.
Yeah, that is good. Okay, Mr. Questenberry, followed by Mr. Buckman.
Yes, I can.
Good. I can attest to the efficacy of sunscreen. I'm actually just 41 years old, and this is too many years on the beach with no sunscreen. I was just going to make a board member report. I was fortunate enough on the 22nd of January to meet with Craig Stewart, the association president. Actually, we were getting together initially to discuss a student that's on home hospital, and I'm helping this young lady with some of her assignments and so forth. But we did have a kind of a wide-ranging discussion about what's the role of a board member, and how I feel about being wearing a different hat than I had in the past, which led us to kind of a discussion of the trials, tribulations, and challenges of being and a teachers association union president and so forth. So anyway, I just thought the board members might want to know that. Thank you.
Mr. Buckman.
Thank you. Last Thursday night I had the pleasure of attending Hawthorne's family math night, and I go to as many of those as I can, hoping to discover what the gap is in my math education. But it was absolutely incredible that the students just totally focused, having a great time with math, and parents in there just totally blown away, and the staff just so proud of what they were accomplishing. And so I just wanted to let everybody know I didn't find the answer that I needed, but I think the kids and the parents and the teachers were.
Well, I'll piggyback on that because I was also there. And although I didn't see you, we must have been traveling. We were moving in different circles. I thought it was terrific, and there was a huge turnout. And I'm not attributing it to the free pizza. I think it had totally to do with parent and child interest in math. I was at the kindergarten table, and I remember my own children. I'm trying to think back, but I think it was maybe second or third grade at back-to-school night. The teacher said, if you want to help your child, to give your child a leg up, you'll work with them on concepts of time and money. And because they're difficult concepts, and the teacher said, we just don't have enough time to devote to them. And at the kindergarten table, they are working on concepts of money. I just couldn't believe it. It's just everything is so accelerated, and the kids are so excited. They're so excited by what they're doing. In the 4, 5, and 6 in the library, the fifth graders had these very complicated problems and little boards, and they were doing arrows and figuring things out just fast and really enjoying it. And the parents seemed enthralled by what was going on. So I would say, and I'm sure that Hawthorne was representative of math nights across the district. It's really an opportunity for parents to see what's going on and be impressed by their kids and dismayed by their own aptitude. So on that note, if there's nothing further, we will stand adjourned.
Next time, I'll be sure I sit next to the